Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 121, where Greta, Rohan, and Tom are discussing Mark Zabrocki's article, The Rhetoric and Reality of Total Quality Management, published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1998. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So yeah, now that we've discussed the model, I think I wanted to revisit two theoretical puzzles that he sets up in the beginning and how some of his findings contribute to that. So the kind of theoretical contributions of this paper, because as you can imagine, when he's starting this paper and talking about just this distinction between rhetoric and reality, a skeptical reader will immediately think, okay, but you know, May and Rowan already spoke about this, or DiMaggio and Powell already talked about this. And he talks about two puzzles, one in the rhetoric dimension, one in the reality dimension, that arise if we take kind of extant institutional theory as is. The first one in the rhetoric dimension is about how institutional theory, and this especially this kind of ceremonial conformity, would suggest that the managers who are engaging in rhetoric are doing it as rhetoric. So they know that they are decoupling from reality. And the point is that it's marketing or it's signaling legitimacy. But what we see in the TQM movement is that the proponents actually believe in it as a real thing that works. And I think part of, like, I understand that puzzle a bit better when I think about his finding of selective storytelling, where the manager or the leader could genuinely believe that this is a great and successful thing because it's the success stories that are coming back up to them, or that they are choosing to retain, which is what we see in kind of stage three of the model. And so then it's not actually a skeptical or a cynical decoupling, but the person who's spouting the rhetoric genuinely believes in the reality as well, but that's because they're seeing only a part of the reality through this selective storytelling mechanism within the organization. And then second puzzle from extant institutional theory, which is on the dimension now more of reality, that Mark sets up, is that we would also expect over time, through kind of the isomorphic pressures that DiMaggio and Powell talk about, we would expect the practices to become more narrow and convergent, the same few things, because more and more organizations are adopting it just for the sake of adopting it or for the sake of signaling legitimacy. But what he sees in the TQM case is that over time, it's actually becoming more diffuse what people are doing, the reality itself in different organizations and settings. And I think the answer to that puzzle comes from this more, from really looking at the whole process model of the variation, selection, retention, and how things diffuse because organizations are really grappling with the rhetoric and the reality over time, and then it creates different pathways.
Yeah, I like that. And what it also kind of speaks to me is sort of how there's almost like a meta rhetoric. There's like two layers of rhetoric. There's the rhetoric of what the organization tells itself. And then there's, I don't want to say face saving, but that's almost what it is at a point. Because even in some cases where maybe the manager does recognize that something is not working, to what extent does their legitimacy require that, you know, their need for legitimacy require them to keep the happy face on and even invent the success stories or oversell success in order to maintain their own legitimacy or give them an out if they think that they're about to be kicked out the door because the whole thing failed?
Yeah, and I think this idea of those two kinds of rhetorics also leads to one interesting thing in the paper, which I would say is almost kind of a good learning lesson or implication for organizations, is suppose you have that second kind of rhetoric, not the meta, the one where the manager does know that they are just doing this as rhetoric. What Mark shows is how sometimes the manager or the leader could be doing something, could be playing in the symbolic realm, but the employees take it seriously. And so it affects reality anyways. And so then leaders need to be careful about that, where if they are doing something strategically or in a signaling manner, but it ends up affecting the reality of your organization because the employees take it very seriously because they are just trying to figure out what the leader has on their mind, you could inadvertently affect the reality of the organization as well.
As I was reading the paper, I saw these really as translation steps. First, you have like the external communication and external rhetoric about TQM, bringing it into the organization. You have to translate it. Also, not just from external to internal, but also lower in the hierarchy. So we have all these steps of translation. And then when you look at how do work outputs get communicated up in the hierarchy, you also have all this translation. You know, as we have like the famous study of, was it the Challenger disaster with the O-ring? How in communication upwards, details get filtered out. Here you also see successes get reported because that gives you a promotion, failures not. I think in technology companies, you see there are often reflection sessions when there's a system breakdown, like what went wrong. But what role did that play in TQM when initiative didn't produce the results they were hoping for? Why didn't that a best practice emerge in TQM? Anyway, I was just reflecting on what we can learn from this study, not just theoretically, but also practically. It's quite a critical story about TQM. As a management fashion, it became very popular and then declined in popularity. After TQM, we had like business process reengineering, Six Sigma, the balanced scorecard, the rise of knowledge management as a new management innovation, agile management, holacracy, design thinking, OKRs. Like every time there's a new thing that you have to adopt and embrace as an organization. I think, you know, of those, like agile has been the most profound, moving up the hierarchy and horizontally from software engineer to other parts of the organization that now also have to embrace agile methodology. But what can we learn in terms of how management innovations, management practices diffuse as they get adopted? I think this is a great story. It has led to a whole line of research within organization and management research. Like Shaz Ansari published a paper about it in AMR. Together with Juliana Reinecke, he published a paper in JMS about how practices are made to vary in order to foster adoption. But as we reflect upon Mark's paper, like what can managers learn from this study? I would love to hear your thoughts.
I think I can help with starting with a bit of a story, kind of from an insider look. This came up when I was still serving and I was in a high command somewhere, just a couple of years after this paper was published. And the balanced scorecard was being adopted as a best practice. And balanced scorecard, without getting into too much detail, is TQM written by somebody else. Okay. And I think I could summarize it kind of like that. Trying to achieve the same ideas, perhaps a little more emphasis on quantification. The idea that you could have a dashboard of which critical information is continuously available and updated so that managers can make quick, rapid, effective decisions on how to improve performance or whatever. You know, it was an external mandate. We will all do this, irrespective of whether or not anybody thought it would be any good. Surprise, it didn't last very long because none of us, you know, going back to even the very beginnings at the selection phase, when we started to learn about what it was very difficult for us to understand what was it actually making us do different. But what was it adding to everybody's plate to actually present the data in a way that was useful to populate the dashboard and actually make it work? As a data engineer, I found the whole thing ludicrous, but I was a very junior data engineer at the time and didn't have much of a voice in the process. Okay, so, but anybody who's with a data engineering background who's knows that if you're in a dealing with an area where all of your data-ish is actually qualitative, anecdotal, cannot be summarized or quantified in a reliable fashion, any decision-making paradigm that relies on quantity becomes unusable. there's a layer of rhetoric that drives, I think, the desire to continue to pursue these sorts of packaged interventions. And the packaged intervention idea is like, you know, this is the difference between why don't we adopt the quality control process as it was designed, independent of having TQM? Why would we need to implement a balanced scorecard? Why couldn't we just divide it up into its little parts and, you know, just pick this, pick that, adopt what makes the most sense? Thank you very much. And we've figured it out. And that social legitimacy really comes into play because there are myths associated with how you improve performance that I think drives the variation step. This is a very broad assertion, but you know, just think about it. If you're in an organization or an industry that just for whatever reason values quantification, then managers are going to find themselves wanting to grab to something that quantifies what goes on in their organization. And you're going to end up in the cycle of pick a model. Once it fails, because it will, you pick another model. Once it fails, and it will. To me, the lesson becomes, what do you really think is performance? And what is it about the data or the information that is already available in the organization is not scratching the itch that you're improving performance? I'm sort of advocating here for a much more bottom-up approach, as opposed to, let's look for the shiny object, the shiny plan sitting on a shelf somewhere, and try to bludgeon it into an organization, which I think is the easy solution. It makes somebody look like they're doing something when they're really not.
Yeah, and I think one way in which this paper is useful in that sense is that regardless of whether you are taking a new, shiny new kind of package thing from the outside, or you're building something bottom up, it's the kind of the dimensions of analysis that are relevant to a manager or an employee or someone. And I think all good qual papers do this, where it's not necessarily this exact process model that you can map onto other settings, but it changes just the way of your thinking, or it gives you some conceptual toolkit that you can use in other settings. And so if I was a manager or an employee, thinking about what's the rhetoric here, what's the reality, and how are the two influencing each other, thinking about anticipating that there will be a variation selection retention process at each stage of this larger process, anticipating selective storytelling, are all things that have practical value to me. For example, the selective storytelling thing, of course, where I would maybe actively seek out failure stories from teams because I'm aware of this, the way this model could go, and I'm trying to influence what I want my organization to do. So I think, yeah, one kind of implication of a paper, this paper, but any papers like this in general, is the more conceptual framing or toolkit that it gives, that you can then take those tools and apply them to your own setting or organization. And the actual details of the process will vary, you know, greatly perhaps, but it's still helpful to be cognizant about, okay, what's the gap between rhetoric and reality? What's happening in terms of the VSR process and so on and so forth?
Adding to that, I've also been thinking about the assumptions that lie behind a lot of these management innovations, these management fashions. And one of them that Mark points out is this assumption of rational decision-making in organizations. We can question whether decision-making is always rational or whether there are irrational elements. Managers may make decisions to their own interests, for instance, not always in the organization's best interest. Another one is seeing reality as an objective reality that's out there. This is often, you know, how engineers think, because they're working more with physical material behaves as they think it does, instead of looking at reality as socially constructed, which is the view that Mark takes in his paper, building upon Berger and Lockman's work, which we also have an episode on, I believe, the social construction of daily life. And so if these foundational assumptions do not match reality, what is then the utility of trying to implement their ideas? Is there a fundamental disconnect there? Another thing that I would love to discuss is what Mark wrote on page 620. And that is about, I guess, like this relation between managers and workers. And like I guess you have something to say about this, Tom. But let me just say out loud what he's writing here. There is the defense contractor employees in the training sessions that Mark attended said, when the managers implement TQM, they are dating it, trying it out to see if they want a long-term relationship with TQM. They still lack the cognitive structures to apply TQM tools appropriately, and consequently their TQM effort looks like experiments. 2 points, at least 1 point, but maybe two here. And then one is that managers don't really know what they're implementing. They think it's potentially a solution to the problems that they're facing, but they don't really go and study it before implementing it in the organization. And I guess the second one is taking the relationship with your workers very seriously. Like, you want them to take part in a major change initiative and making them feel as if they are part of your experiment, your passion project, doesn't make them fully committed. It makes them feel used. And I think when you really want to incorporate organizational change, you need their buy-in. And that is also what the model shows. You need that integration in reality closely related to the work floor in order to make TQM successful. And that is not unique to TQM. I think that is a key element of any way you try to manage your organization. I found that those words there quite fundamental in showing a worker's perspective to how managers try to, you know, launch new change initiatives.
I agree. And if you were to pull all of the major, you know, popular change literature that's out there today, I would venture to say I don't think there's a single one out there that doesn't include some sort of foot stomp about buy-in. You know, and it doesn't have to be everybody across the organization, but a level of organizational preparation is a vital component of implementing change. It's definitely proffered that way in the present. However, one of the challenges that I've seen, you know, which is, I think, sort of fueled some of my negative experiences with these, is the pressure to act and act quickly, which can be overwhelming to the middle managers or to, you know, anybody below the senior levels who are trying to do this in effect on top of their what they're already doing. When he showed in the diagrams that the training and was only with a small subset, there's something to be said about if you really aren't 100% sure that or confident in what the intervention is going to accomplish for you, then the best thing to do is do pilots and experiments and set a part of the organization aside to test things out, you know, exercise a little bit of learning rather than try to force feed it on the organization all at once. But we have to acknowledge that sometimes, you know, regardless of what type of organization you're in, the pressures upon managers to show improvement, to show that they're doing everything that they can lead to sort of like a shoot first and ask questions later, you know, to impose something on an unwitting organization to get it done quickly. It doesn't matter necessarily whether it succeeds or not, as long as there's that legitimacy granted by appearing to do something. Overwhelming majority of the organizations that I've been in avoid that. They want the buy-in because they know that that approach fails. But unfortunately, sometimes not every change effort or every requirement for an intervention allows for that time or the bandwidth, as we like to call it, for the organization to build up the buy-in. They're told, do it now or else. And, you know, what do you do? You just do it to the best of your ability.
I was also thinking about the manager of that manufacturing firm that then left and became a TQM consultant. And why this case was actually the one that maybe was the most successful in implementing TQM out of the 5 cases. And, you know, it may be that because it's a manufacturing firm, maybe he understood the method more, maybe the method fitted the context better. But I'm also thinking about like promotion systems of managers. And I think especially in the 90s, a lot of managers in manufacturing firms were promoted internally rather than hired externally. So, you know, one assumption I have is he actually understood the work that was happening and how TQM could be implemented because he knew how the organization operated. So it's this connection between leadership and the workers. How much does leadership actually know what workers do and change that in sensible ways? But yeah, those are just some of my reflections. Like, why was this case different from the four other ones?
And that comes back to, I think in part one, we were talking about how it's interesting to have this kind of a study design where you're not trying to make it, you know, as matched as possible with just one dimension of difference. And that's why we get this complex kind of story and this more high-level process view at the level of VSR, etc. But what you lose in the process is the ability to answer these questions, because my instinct in this example is that, okay, maybe it is the best fit for manufacturing. Then I'm curious, maybe if I separately look at just TQM consultants, are most TQM consultants people from manufacturing settings? In which case it could simply be that this setting was meaningfully different from the four other cases, which explains why you saw this different outcome in this case. I also wanted to circle back, Greta, on your point about this underlying assumption of social construction versus objective reality. I think that's where this paper is playing. It's trying to bridge the two, because some of what, for example, Mark talks about in his discussion section, if you were trained in the Moberger and Luckman kind of school and you were a stronger like social constructivist, it wouldn't be news to you. So for example, in page 630, Mark says, the models presented here suggest that the use of TQM rhetoric has a very serious technical intent. The social construction of TQM is not simply a symbolic process. Now, for social constructivists, the fact that it's not simply a symbolic process is the starting point of their analysis. The point is that, yes, exactly, you're constructing all of reality and all of with very real consequences through this social process. But in this case, I guess there's still that underlying assumption of, which is why the whole dichotomy, let's say, if you're talking to a very strong constructivist, they might, or if you had a reviewer of that school, they might even be troubled by the whole technical versus real, or the whole rhetoric and reality channels in the organization. Again, a very strong constructivist, we would say there's no such thing as TQM as an entity outside of any inhabited practice in a given organization. But that would be a whole other way to go about studying this practice, of course.
I guess the last sentence of the paper gives a more moderate contribution to that debate, and saying, you know, we must take the social construction of managerial practices seriously, but we must also look for the serious technologies within those practices.
I would add that we must also take the social construction of academic practices seriously, because, you know, I mean, this is gets back to what we were saying early in the paper, where this, you know, we defined rhetoric, or Mark defined rhetoric, focusing on what the managers say and do. But the point about the champion who was a manager and went on to be a TQM consultant also speaks to perhaps a different area of rhetoric and reality that is perhaps useful to explore. And I imagine that there's a great analog here, is the ones who really did the initial packaging. We know of scholars who have come up with a model or a practice in which they themselves become the champion for. And I think there's a rhetoric and reality distinction worth exploring there, because I'll give an example without naming any names or organizations. It was not military organization, but it was a scholar who is a renowned name, I'll just put it that way, somebody we would probably recognize, who was asked to come in and do some consultation work in the organization, brought the tool that the scholar had developed and was known for. Implementation went totally off the rails. It was not successful. And the sense that I got from talking with the people who were involved in this was that there was a very significant distance between the rhetoric and the reality of the tool and the scholar. I have in the past, maybe even in this program, have talked a lot about how sometimes management consultants come in and foist their preferred model upon an unsuspecting and vulnerable organization as, you know, sort of like as a way of justifying the money that's being paid to them for them doing the consulting. The rhetoric reality divide, I don't think is in any way, you know, confined to the question of managerial behaviors. It's also on the other side of the ones who are developing and producing these packaged solutions. it kind of gets at their legitimacy and what they are rewarded for. Because obviously I do the same thing. I have my own set of tools that I help consult with organizations. And I'm trying to be very, very careful never to present my tool as the one best way. I learn and adapt my tools every single time I use them. But that doesn't always happen.
And the gap can be in both ways. One is where they're kind of leveraging the rhetoric reality gap for the sake of, you know, foisting it onto an unsuspecting organization. Or it could be that they're unhappy about it. So the paper, in fact, begins with a quote from Edwards Deming, who is one of the people who did some of that statistical work and built the models that underlie TQM. And the quote says, "The term is counterproductive. My work is about a transformation in management and about the profound knowledge needed for the transformation. Total quality stops people from thinking." And so here, an instance of academic who's aware of and unhappy about the rhetoric reality gap.
So I think part of the takeaways perhaps is just a recognition of when you go into a situation, like if we were to go in and do consulting, to what extent are we going to be able to assess the potential for a rhetoric reality gap? My experience has been that typically organizations are open about what problems they face, but they're going to be naturally guarded with how much they expose themselves regarding the problems that they're having. You know, they'll let you know what it is that's going on and give you enough information where you can get kind of started doing a little bit of diagnostic work or whatever, but not every organization is going to be so open. And if you find that there's a potential for a rhetoric reality gap to emerge, I guess, you know, if we're thinking about applying these ideas in some way, that should be a warning signal, I would think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it made me think about, you know, the illusion of best practices and what works in one organization may not work in another. It depends on the context, how it gets implemented, how it diffuses within the organization. And I guess, you know, coming back to the dialectics, you need both rhetoric to sell it, to get people motivated, but you also need to understand the reality really well. What's going on? How can it be implemented? Why are you asking people to do extra work? How will you reward it? And I think, yeah, it's just a very complex process. And I think this paper just gives a lot of reflections after reading it. Like, what can we learn about fostering implementations, fostering organizational changes, what to do, but mostly what not to do.
But what your comment just spurred is a thought about, you know, it's one thing, for example, for a tool that we develop ourselves, so that we, when we go into an organization, being invited in and asked to help, and we have enough of a deep understanding of our own work that, okay, we can ask the right questions, we can figure out how to massage the process in order to make it fit any context that would be appropriate. Now, if you're a large consulting firm of which you have tools, to what extent would the members of that organization feel comfortable having the same level of adaptability? Or are they sort of taking the tool off the shelf as a full-fledged package plan with limited autonomy, flexibility, or whatever and then you start getting into this issue of foisting, of inflicting the tool upon the organization. I have never worked in a management consultant firm. I do not know in any way, shape, or form to what extent that's an issue, just from sort of being on the other end of it, seeing consulting firms come in with a team. That's the impression that I get, is that, you know, if they weren't the ones who actually had a agency in building the tool, themselves may not be comfortable adapting it when we come back and say, your thing is not fitting. We have a different problem set, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Tom, I think one key, not assumption, but at least kind of underlying variable in this whole study is that it's a practice that composes of multiple sub-practices. And so there are many ways to configure. You might have certain tools or frameworks that are built in such a standardized way, or perhaps such a complex way that people are just trying to adopt it more. But then it becomes an older, more like kind of DiMaggio and Powell adoption story of they're just doing it for the sake of doing it. The value to the organization is just they can say that, okay, we hired this management consultancy and they've come and installed this practice, but the consultants don't really know it and don't know it enough to adapt it or tweak it. The buyers don't really know it enough to adapt it or tweak it, or perhaps it can't be adapted or tweaked for whatever reason. And then that gives you a more collapsed version of the story. I think a lot of this richness comes from having a set of practices that can be configured and are malleable, or you can kind of work with.
Do we want to give our final reflections?
So, I mean, just to wrap up here, if I reflect on when I first came across this paper, which was during my PhD program, and now revisiting it perhaps for the first time since then, so it's not like I've read it many times either, but the reason I think it is such a prominent piece and that continues to stay on, you know, PhD syllabi is not that TQM continues to be a big topic. Like Greta very well pointed out, there's been a whole host of other such concepts and tools and perhaps fashions and fads come and go. But what makes this paper an enduring one for me is both the actual content of it, of like we said, this tool, this conceptual toolkit of just having that lens in your mind of what's the rhetoric versus reality and how are they influencing each other and how is that nested at different levels of the organization, as well as the variation selection retention idea, which also kind of harks back to some of, for example, the Jim March and Olson garbage can model kind of piece where there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in an organization. It harks back to Carl Weick on kind of attention in organizations and how you're responding to what you attend to. And so similarly, the selective storytelling, for me, it all fits in this broader, richer understanding of what's actually happening in organizations, which is why I appreciate this paper. As well as, of course, as a qualitative scholar, it's a good one to go to in terms of how do you tell a process story and in a non-templatized way, right? So he's not doing your standard, what is now quite common, your open AXL and aggregate coding or those kinds of methodologies. But the way he's building the story and the process model is useful for any process scholars as well.
I guess I'll go next and just sort of follow up that, excellent points. And my additional takeaway is I always love it when, you know, some of my own experiences, I get a chance to look at it through a theoretical lens and realize that, you know what, what I experienced was not all that unique. And it's good to see this and see this this being looked at, because managers are, the broad statement, of course, managers are always under tremendous pressures to improve their organizations, to perform, to, you know, whatever it is. There's always going to be a desire for silver bullet solutions. You know, there's also a little bit of a Taylorism in here somewhere, that silver bullet solution is the one best way to solve things. And it's a very attractive thing, because in the complexity of the organizational environment, you never have time, don't have the patience, don't have the leeway to examine all of the problems of the organization to the depth that they probably deserve. And thus, these kind of ready-made solutions are always going to appear appealing. And it's useful to consider what it is that makes them appealing and what it is that will be a natural pitfall, no matter what solution it is, that the manager is going to have to contend with anyway if that solution is going to be implemented. I think that's one of the wonderful things about this paper is that it gives me a little bit more of a sense of what to look for, how to engage with an organization, so that if I'm going to proffer a tool, I don't want the rhetoric reality gap to be that wide. I don't want to put the manager in a bad position when I'm done and I leave.
Those are beautiful points, Tom. I was just reflecting on what a joy it was to revisit this paper. Just like Rowan, I had to read this paper during my PhD, and I think that's true for many doctoral students in management degrees. I would say, like, just the beauty and elegance and the insights you gain from reading this paper, it's beautifully written up. While it is such a complex study, I mentioned this in part one, like the data set, the design of the study, 5 different companies, very different in nature, interviewing and observing people across the hierarchy with very different perspectives. You know, if I would think back, like, during my doctoral research, it must have been a nightmare to analyze this data in the beginning and think, how do I make sense of it? But then that is also like, if you are a doctoral student, you're interested in doing qualitative research, spend 5 hours reading this paper, look at the method section, look at how Mark set up his interviews, how he piloted the interviews to know what questions to ask to study rhetoric, but also to study reality. Because often when we do interviews, we only hear what people say they do, but we cannot figure out what they actually did. That is the key criticism of interview-based studies. Like, because managers are really good in, you know, just saying, oh yeah, I do this and this. And that in essence, like, you know, some of the firms, they only did brainstorming, I believe, and they called it TQM. So really teasing out, even when you have limited access to pump into an organization around interviews, you know, Mark said, hey, can you give me a tour through the company? And then he saw other people and he asked them some questions and he made it turned them into field notes. Like, I think this is beautiful and it's such an example of good qualitative work. And I guess it also links back to the second last sentence of this piece. And I would say here, this is my interpretation as a researcher. Only by treating practices like TQM seriously, as sectors of reality with legitimate technical content and institutional meanings, can we truly consider what managers mean when they say they have implemented TQM, what employees mean when they say they respond to those statements, and ultimately how the meaning of those practices evolve, gain institutional value, and perhaps shift in their technical meaning. I thought that was a nice way to end this episode. Thank you.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.